So we're going to be talking about Simcha, and one of the things that struck me as very, very strange in Kohelet was the pasuk that has the words in it, Simcha Maza Oseh. What does Simcha do? It seemed to be very apparent. You know, Simcha does a lot. Simcha is the oil that makes life something more than ordinary and bestial. Without Simcha, is there any real tefillah? Is there any real yearning? Is there any real chesed if you can't have the Simcha of seeing another person's face? If it's mechanical to you? So I never understood the pasuk. So I did what teachers often do in circumstances like that. I translated it and went on. Okay. But I was never satisfied with this. So when I looked into the Mefarshim, it didn't help that much. They would say, the Simcha of this world, what does it do? Since we don't know anything about the Simcha of the other world, that didn't tell me anything. So I want to talk to you about illusory Simcha, I want to talk to you about real Simcha, and I want to talk to you about what Simcha is not. So first, illusory Simcha. One sort of illusory Simcha is the good feeling we have when we do something and it works. You know, so you train for the job and you got the job. Okay, you went on the diet and you lost the weight, which is a greater miracle. Okay. And, you know, you got your morning act together, you got on the train. Okay, so there's a certain sort of simcha that tells you, you know what? I'm in charge, I'm in control, and it works. That sort of simcha has its origin in Roman thought. The Romans they had three main schools of philosophy. I'm sure you were thinking today, one of the three main schools of Roman philosophy. So gosh, here's your chance. Okay, whatever. So one school was academia, which means that they thought that knowledge was power. Knowledge defines everything. So I want to tell you about the illusion of knowledge being simcha. Okay, if a doctor has a bad news diagnosis to give over, they don't say, hope you have insurance. That isn't how they put it. They say, well, here's the condition, and here's what I see, and here are the possibilities, and this is what we'll do. So the information itself gives you a feeling of control. This is why we're so news, are any of you news junkies? Okay, so those of us who are news junkies are familiar with this feeling. Those of you who don't admit to being news junkies will still know it. You hear about something that's happening and you find out all the facts. And it gives you the illusion of being able to control events, especially if you have an opinion. Okay, so you decide who should do what, and now you feel it's going to be okay. So that's one school of thought. Now, in order for a lie to be believed, there has to be a certain dimension of truth. If I were to tell you I'm really 22 but very tired, okay, you wouldn't go for that. So there has to be a certain amount of truth in a lie. So the truth in the legend of academia, the idea of knowledge equals power equals simcha, is that knowledge indeed gives you a connection to something above yourself. That's the last thing the Romans would have said. Okay, another sort of philosophy they developed was hedonism. Meaning, if it feels good, do it. If it looks good, own it. Okay, so this is totally foreign to you, I'm sure. Okay, the ad industry is based on this premise that, you know, you could be happy. All you have to do is own a, taste a, have a, and then you'll be happy. Because they assume that happiness comes from experience. So the way that goes is as follows. It's a terribly sad equation. The truth is that not having really makes you unhappy. If a person is hungry. You know, one of the legends that we propagate is that back in the shtetl, everything was rosy. You know, people were starving to death, but they were happy. Okay, no. So the fact is that people are deprived. If a person is hungry, they're not happy. If a person has no clothing to wear in the winter, they're not happy. But the fact that you have what you need doesn't mean you will be happy. So it's a terribly sad equation. Not having makes you unhappy, but yes, having doesn't necessarily make you happy. What happens is you raise the rod. So if you have your bare necessities, you want more than your bare necessities, then you'll be happy. If you have everything money could buy, which is extremely unlikely, then there are other things you'll feel, if I only had, then I'd be happy. And it doesn't end. The third school of thought is the Spartan ethic, which is, if I overcome the challenges that I set before me, then I'll be happy. So those of us who in our sinful youths saw moving pictures on the screen accompanied by sound may be familiar with climb every mountain, ford every stream, and I bet half of you know the next line. And the other half don't know what I'm talking about. Okay. So the idea there is, of course, that your dream will be fulfilled as long as you meet the challenge that you set before yourself. So it's this third kind of simcha, which again, there has to be a dimension of truth there, otherwise nobody would believe it, that I want to talk to you about as being vain. How so? So I'm going to talk to you very personally about the events that preceded my husband's patira recently. So he was doing okay as far as people of a certain age do. And he developed arrhythmia, which means that his heartbeat was uneven. Okay, so the doctor prescribed blood thinners because he wanted him to have a certain process done, a procedure involving electricity, for which a person's blood density had to be at a certain level. The blood thinners did not agree with him, but he was taking them. And the doctor first said it would be for a week, but it didn't work in a week, so maybe 2 weeks, 3 weeks, then it was Sukkot, then the doctor went on vacation. So I'm giving you that as a backdrop, because I don't for a moment believe that this is a direct causative of anything, but this is the backdrop to other things. So here it is. Okay, it's Mitzvah Shabbos. We just got back from a very beautiful Shabbos where everything went well. Okay, and there was this feeling of, you know, we did it. We had a really good Shabbos. Everything went perfectly, like clockwork. You could like check off every item. And I went out for a walk. I came home. I expected my husband to be asleep. I often go out to walk late at night and find everybody asleep because it's their minhag to sleep at night. Okay, some people have this minhag. But he wasn't, he was up, we were talking. Then he sort of slipped down off the bed, which sounds strange when you don't know our beds. Our beds are the same beds that we have from the Sochnut when we made Aliyah 45 years ago. And they, like many other things, they aren't what they used to be. So it's not that, you know, like they say it, whatever. That in and of itself wasn't so unusual, but he couldn't get up. So I tried to help him. It didn't work. So I called the Hatzala. So here's the first check on the list. They came there almost immediately. Okay, so that means things should work, right? Okay. And the volunteer who came so happened to be a former student from Or Sameach. Here's another check on the list. Extremely empathetic, very helpful. Okay. He said, come, give me your hand, I'll help you get up. He gave him his hand. He said, give me your other hand. And he said, I am, which made us realize he thought that he was giving him the other hand, but he wasn't. So we realized what was happening. He called an ambulance, which came immediately. Here's another check on the list. Okay, and the ambulance, the paramedic asked, do you feel any pain? And he said, no. which was the last words that we heard him say. The speech became incoherent thereafter. But we still have the checklist. Okay, we got to the emergency room. The neurologist was there waiting for us, which is unheard of. The emergency room isn't a place where they say, oh, we were waiting for you. Thank you for coming. Well, the emergency room, that's where I once actually saw somebody, like, literally dying, where they're asking for his Tudat Zehut number. Like this, so this was unheard of. Okay, the neurologist ordered a scan. The scan was terrible. And, but it was done immediately. And we began to, I called my children, they were there with me. Okay, we consulted with the medical askanim. They recommended Dr. Chashuv. Okay, so Dr. Chashuv, who actually turned out to be a very Chashuv doctor, his name is Chassan Cohen, very professional, very affable, just affirmed what was said already. But we had the check on the list, we got the top neurologist. Of course, when they recommended him as the top neurologist and they said he treated Sharon, this did not make me feel any better. I was supposed to be very impressed. I just like didn't, I said, oh. Okay. Everything else that could possibly be done, we consulted with Rebbeim who are normally inaccessible. Everybody was there. Everything that could be done was done, and you know what? It didn't make any difference at all. So the reason I'm telling you this isn't in bitterment. I'm not bitter about this. I think that everybody did what they should do and better than they could be expected to do. But human efforts are not the key to simcha. That's not where the key is hidden. Human efforts change you as a person. So the Hatzalah volunteer, the paramedic, the Rebbe's who answered the phone in the middle of the night. In fact, the progression of asking Rebbe's went as follows. I tried to call my husband's Rosh Yeshiva, but the call didn't go through. I then called the Amshinova Rebbe's mother. Now it was 4 in the morning at this point, which to her is like 4 in the afternoon. So she answered immediately. And I asked her whether she thought adding a name would be appropriate. So this is, of course, to get her to ask her son. And he said that he felt he didn't want to take responsibility for this decision. And he recommended that we speak either to the Rachman Strifka Rebbe or to another Rebbe in Bnei Brak whose name eludes me right now, who I never heard of. And I have a friend whose husband is Rachman Strifka Chassid, so I called her. Now it's 4:20 in the morning. Her husband answered. I didn't know this, but he was in the middle of sitting Shiva. He didn't tell me anything. He heard what I was saying, and he said, I'll take care of it. He got a hold of the Rebbe's Gabbai, who got a hold of the Rebbe, who answered back that not to change, not to add anything. But getting through to so many people at that time of night was an unusual thing. And again, I'm not speaking from embitterment. I think that they change as people. Being available to people at all hours that way is a huge schus. That the Rebbe's mother picked up the phone is a huge schus. That my friend's husband put aside himself in every sense of the word to take care of somebody else is a huge schus. But if you think it changes anything on the outside, there is nothing we do that changes anything at all on the outside. So I want you to detach from this sort of melodrama for a moment and think about the little simchas that we have during the day, for which we do whatever we do, and we make our checklist, and we think that we're making changes. We put out our tape recorder, and then it's all... No, okay, sorry. Okay, so an example of this is a typical Erev Shabbos. You've got Bina magazine on Wednesday, and you looked at what I personally find the rather depressing recipes, like the 20-step recipes. And take almonds and reduce them to tiny particles by hand because they come out so much better. Okay, whatever. Okay, but you do it and you get this like perfect, you know, perfect chocolate vanilla ice cream that's coated in almond and sugar. Okay, and it looks like it does in the magazine. Okay, is this going to make you happy necessarily? Maybe. And again, what? Maybe not. Okay, so you have the achievement in hand, but even if it turns out perfect, and even if you get the results that you want, everybody enjoys it very much, they thank you, you're going to remember it next year? No. And the reason for this is that the results of our choices on the material world are a very brief endurance. The only thing that lasts long is who you become. So you could have two people doing the same thing. They're making the cake with the ice cream dish. One person is doing it mamish l'kavod Shabbos, and it has to do with affirming this, that Hashem created a world that's beautiful and good and should be celebrated. And the other person is doing the same thing, is doing it because she's running an endless race against what? Against her inner feelings of lack, her inner sense of not being quite okay. So she makes the beautiful cake and she succeeds. Did it change her? No. Okay. So in the first case, does it change her? Yes. So I want to trace what makes simcha real. So here's what simcha isn't. It isn't any of the offshoots of Roman philosophy. They don't bring a person simcha in any way that endures. Neither do the other escapes that we have. So I want to talk about fun for a moment. Now personally, I like fun. I have no prejudice against fun. What do you guys do for fun? What do people do for fun in Queens, if anything? I never think of Queens as being like such a fun place. Maybe I'm wrong. Now, what do people do for fun in Queens? They go to a shir for entertainment. No, I'm not. Swimming. Anything else? Eating. Okay, so the way things go with fun is the more the fun takes you away from yourself, the better you like it. So if you like swimming, you want to be, if you're good at it, you want to be swimming laps, you want the pool to be deep enough and wide enough, an Olympic pool maybe. You don't want to be in the baby pool paddling. Okay, if you like games of skill, you want to do something that forces you to sometimes lose. Playing chess with a good chess player is fun. Playing tiddlywinks like no one at our age wants like a rousing game of tic-tac-toe. You're just like, it's not, you know, like, wow. Okay. It doesn't take you out of yourself. We all know the trick how to win if you go first, right? So for something to be fun, it has to take you out of your reality. I'm sure some of us read novels, okay? Even the from novels, endeavor to take you out of your reality. You become the characters, so you're not yourself for those moments when you're reading it. So why do we want to get out of self? So I want you to look at our society, which is not a very happy society. Have you noticed what people look like on the train? Are you sure she's alive? Okay, well, you know. The way Hashem constructed us is that we need to escape from ourselves. In today's society especially, there are people who are uncomfortable with themselves to the degree that they can't be by themselves for 5 minutes without looking for something else to draw them away from self. Texting, talking, turning on the computer. You could see where this is so? What happens when you're with yourself and there's nothing on the outside to distract you? You have to face your own boredom with yourself. Okay, that place can be very boring, unstimulating. Okay, we continually seek the company of other people. So the purpose of that inner empty space is to draw you into a relationship with Hashem. So I want to illustrate to you how this works. Okay, so there are all sorts of distractions. I gave you examples of some. Even relationship is a distraction. When you think about the people who you like the best, and you ask yourself, why do I like these people? The answer invariably is spiritual. People like people who are intelligent or compassionate or loyal. These aren't things you could weigh and measure. Now, if you feel the way you describe the person who you want to be with when you're with them, you feel intelligent, you feel compassionate, you feel loyal, you like them even better. The name of that is spiritual bonding, and this is the greatest pleasure life holds. The empty space should be telling you, bond. But the ultimate bond is with Hashem. So what we do sometimes is that we try to find something with which to bond by the external means we discussed earlier. Competition with self against self, pleasure, okay, controlling life through knowledge, whatever it is. So that's what simcha isn't. What it is this feeling of being complete, being attached, being bonded. So nobody uses this vocabulary, so I want to bring this back to words that we're more familiar with. Okay, so I'll tell you a true story, and I want you to tell me what the story evokes. So as you know, just two nights ago was Rav Ovadia Yosef Shloshim. So I have a lot of Rav Ovadia stories. I live on Rehov Kablan, I live on Kablan 29, and he was in Kablan 45. So by the nature of things, a lot of the stories would float all the way from 45 to 29. So when he was young, so owning a sefer was totally out of the question. Today we have no way of relating to poverty the way it was in Eretz Yisrael in those days. His father had a little grocery store, and you can't run a grocery store alone. There has to be someone behind the counter and somebody else who takes in supplies, puts them on the shelves. So his father always had a helper. Things were so bad, he had to let the helper go because he wasn't making enough money to pay him and to support his family at all. So he had his oldest son help him in the store, Rav Ovadia. So in those days, of course, people didn't have phones. No one, I mean, even when I came to Israel, nobody had a phone. So nobody in his school, he went to a Talmud Torah. How many of you ever lived in Yerushalayim? Any amount of time? So you know the Bukharim neighborhood? So on Rehov Yecheskel, the Talmud Torah that Rav Ovadia went to still exists. It's called Bnei Tzion. So that's where he went to school. They didn't know why he wasn't coming. They couldn't just call up the house and ask. So they went down, they heard the story, and at that point, he was so advanced, he was always a protege, that he was also, in addition to learning with kids his own age, he would walk sometimes to Porat Yosef, which in those years was in the old city, and learn there. The Rosh Yeshiva Porat Yosef, Rav Atiyah, Ezra Atiyah, showed up at the grocery store with an apron folded in his hand. He put it on and he told Rav Ovadia's father, I'll stand in the store, send him back. So the father was appalled. Of course, how could that, what are you thinking? He said, he's a protege, you have to give him a chance. Ultimately, it was an Ashkenazi Rav Moshe Koresh who agreed to pay the father whatever it would cost to hire a helper. So with that as a backdrop, when I say owning a sefer wasn't in the cards, you understand what I'm talking about. There's a store which still exists. Again, those of you who've been to Eretz Yisrael or lived there know Rehov Yafo. If you're walking on the Rehov Yafo, on the opposite side of the Shuk, towards Davidka Square, you'll notice a bookstore called Lugasi. Still says it's on the sign Lugasi since 1923. And indeed it is in the family that long. So it's a Sephardi bookstore. This is where you could buy all of the Sephardi, you know, Pitron Chalomos, Chochmas Apartzef, all of those sorts of things. So Rav Avadia, as a young man, used to browse there. And the owner was tolerant of it. One day, he said to the owner, "I'm almost finished with what I'm reading, but I see you want to close up. Let me have the book overnight, and I promise you, I'll be here before you open in the morning, and the book will be perfect. No, it'll be in mint condition." So the owner said yes. Now this became a habit. So he would come every day, but he had to train his memory to be able to finish the book the same night and remember it, because there'd be no way he would get the same book again. Now, you hear this story, you see so many lines crossing Rav Avadia's dedication, the Hashgacha in creating him in a way in which he had to strive that much to rise above his poverty, the generosity of Mr. Lugasi. You see all of these lines crossing? So when you see all of these lines crossing, it touches you on the inside. Could you see where this is set? Give me a few words. What does the story make you feel? And I'm not finished with the story, but just up to this point. What does that make you feel? Put it in words. Awe. What? Someone said something other than awe. What's another word? Trust.
Inspired.
What?
Inspired.
Desire.
Inspired. Yearning. You could see this. Yearning for a certain kind of consciousness, for a world that is no more, for all of this. That's where Simcha comes from. I want to take the story further. Okay, so there he is, the Ilui of Parat Yosef, gets married. The poverty that he was living with was so extreme that they literally were living in a room and a half. This is with, I don't know if they were all born at that point, but eventually there were 11 children. Okay, under the table was a good place to sit. It was quiet, it was relatively private. Okay, that was, he took a position as being Rav of Cairo, which was such a terrible position. His sukkah was literally the only sukkah in all of Cairo. They returned to Eretz Yisrael, and he wanted to go back to Parat Yosef to the Kollel, and they told him, "There's no money." Could you imagine the poverty of the times, that there's no money to give to Rav Ovadia in the Kollel? But what that led him to next was taking Rabbanus in Petach Tikva, which led to his becoming the Rav Rashi. And I want to tell you what it was like when he was the Rav Rashi. The first time I saw him face to face was in Neve. He would come and speak to the Israeli Neve girls every so often. Now, how many girls am I talking about? 40 girls? 50 girls? I don't think there are 50 girls. Okay, but he would go and speak anywhere to anybody because he was there with the people because of where he came from. How does that make you feel? No, where are the words?
Amazed.
Happy, amazed. Okay, compassion. And it strikes you in the place where you want to find that in yourself. And when you do, and you let it take you somewhere, that's what Simcha comes from. So Simcha is the result of inspiration, it's the result of aspiration, it's the result of bonding. Okay, so now that we know what Simcha is, let me tell you some of the obstacles in being a person of Simcha. So first let's say what Simcha looks like, because there's a lot of room for self-deception there. So Norcha Tzadikim, the author says, without any doubt, If a person says, I'm a person of simcha, it'll show. So forget the image of somebody saying, I work on simcha. No. Okay. Or how dare you not suggest I'm not a Baal Simcha? You know, whatever. Okay, it is what it sounds like. There's a certain kind of inner peace. And the inner peace doesn't come from any false sense of I've arrived. It comes from feeling everything in life is good. If it's challenging, that's to cause you to grow. If it's beautiful, it's to give you inspiration. But either way, the vocabulary we had a moment ago, yearning, inspiration, happiness, they're part of your inner vocabulary all of the time. These are what the real Balei Simcha are. So this is what's meant when it says, Or Zarua La Tzadik, light is implanted in a tzaddik. This light is the light of Simcha that's true. So when you say it's planted, when you put seeds in the ground, what happens is that more comes forth from the ground than there were seeds originally. If you plant one tomato seed, you don't get one tomato, you get a whole tomato bush with many tomatoes. So the idea is that simcha begets simcha, meaning that every opportunity for the person to meet challenge and to find inspiration gives them greater and greater simcha. So simcha doesn't have anything to do with ease, which is another illusion. Quite the opposite. In some ways, simcha is the opposite of ease. Simcha, by definition, is dynamic, and ease, by definition, is passive. So there are specific thoughts that a person could develop where they could bring themselves back to simcha. So that would mean, I want to make this clear, if a person's reality, their default is simcha. There are things in life that could distract a person from that. But you have to have thoughts ready to bring you back to yourself. So here's how it works. Give me an example of a difficult life situation.
Illness.
Okay, someone said illness. Okay. So a person, again, whose default is simcha, meaning they will see anything that's hard as a challenge that will generate growth, and anything that's easy and beautiful as an inspiration that will generate growth. Either way, there's growth and response. How will a person like that respond to illness? What do you think? They'll respond to it the way an expert swordsman will respond to a duel. It'll challenge them. They'll cross swords with it. They'll try to maintain some victory, but they'll bring Hashem into the picture. So, in my opinion, this is just my opinion, anybody who knew anything whatsoever about Rav Nassim Tzvi saw brilliant swordsmanship. And remember, the other player is, of course, the Siyata Dishmaya that's drawn down through this. I want to share with you something that actually was one of the strangest things. I mean, a lot of strange things happen to me in life, but this is one of the stranger things. I was in this part of the world, in a modern Orthodox community. And I was there for Shabbos, and I overheard two men talking. They were on the steps of the synagogue, and one of them was saying disparaging things about the yeshiva community. And as we think, you know, he tells his friend, let's call his friend Irv, the strangest thing happened to me last week. You know what I think of these guys who like can't even support their own families and they're studying, keeping the benches warm. You know what I think. But this man came collecting for his yeshiva. I don't remember what his name is right now. He was weird. He was like moving around, and like I could barely understand his talking, but there was something about him. I wrote him a check for $5,000. He did not know why he gave him the money. And I almost said, gotcha! Okay, but I didn't. So what happens is when you win the duel, You draw down energy from above, which gives you further inspiration and further growth and further consciousness and greater simcha. But going back to the thoughts you have to have. So here's the progression. Get the progression. First, notice that you're moving away from your assumed normative state of simcha. Notice this. Notice your feelings. Emotions are not the enemy. People think that because the emotions, which are like the captain of the ship, the Gemara says, that they become so wild and so distracting that they're the enemy. No, the emotions have to listen to the navigator, which is the mind, but the emotions are not the enemy. Notice your feelings. What are some feelings a person might experience if they become terribly ill? Depression. Tell me more. Fear. Anxiety. Okay. Loss of control. The feeling of like, wait a minute, that's not how I planned it. I wasn't going to do this today, I was going to do that today. Yeah. Disappointment. Notice your emotions. That's step one. Step two is look at them. Stand back from your emotions, look at them, and challenge their truth. My emotion is telling me I'm afraid. Is there really something to be afraid of? The answer may be yes. Okay, my emotions are telling me I've lost control. Have I really lost control? The answer may be yes. Okay, look at your emotions, challenge their truth. The fact that you're now engaging your emotions in a way in which your mind is also participant lets you go to the next stage. The next stage is present your emotions with a different sentence. So in Orchot Tzadikim, the author presents us with several different sentences that work under different situations. So I'm going to present you with a few of them, not all of them. First one, Hashem has more compassion for me than I have for myself. Are we very good to ourselves? How many of you would say, yes, we're very good to ourselves? How many of you would say, no, we're not so good to ourselves? You people are so cowardly. Okay. Only two people responded, and they both agreed that we're not too good to ourselves. The rest of us were like, I don't know. Okay. I would say we're not so good to ourselves. We're not so good to ourselves physically. We don't take good care of our bodies. We're not so good to ourselves emotionally. Okay, we aren't so good to ourselves. Hashem is completely compassionate. So it means every single thing Hashem presents us with is because He knows that it's the best of all possible options. So it would mean if you could step back and write your own script. This is the script you would write, not a different one. So to illustrate this, you give me an example of anybody who you would say was a real tzaddik, living, dead, Jewish, non-Jewish, any tzaddik. Come on. Rav Arya Levine, okay? So, I feel a great affinity for Rav Arya, who I didn't know. I knew his son, Rav Raphael. But, so I'll just tell you like one story about him, which you probably know the stories that I know as well, but I'll tell it to you anyway. Okay, I'll tell you actually a story you don't know. So when he was young, that he was living in great poverty, even for the times. The poverty in his household was extreme. And his father wanted him to learn in a certain yeshiva. So in those days, of course, when you go to yeshiva, it doesn't mean that your father buys you an air ticket and you go and you call long distance and you schmooze. It meant that at the age of I think he was 11 and a half, that you say goodbye and maybe you'll see your parents again and maybe you won't. So he went to the yeshiva his father selected for him. And it wasn't right for him. Wasn't the right place. So he left. He couldn't consult. There was no telephone. There was no easy way of consulting. And he went to a different yeshiva. His father never forgave him. So I want you to see this within the framework of the times. In those years, it wasn't unusual for young people to leave yeshivas. Where did they end up most of the time if that was their progression? In the arms of the Haskalah. That's what was going on. So his father perceived, misperceived this as step one away from Yiddishkeit. But it wasn't. But their relationship was never the same. What was his bar mitzvah like? Went to shul one morning, and he realized the date. And he asked somebody in the shul, could I use your tefillin when you're finished? And the man said, sure, why? He says, because I don't have any. So he said, where are your bar mitzvah tefillin? And he said, today is my bar mitzvah. So this is what he was coming from. So could you see where if he didn't have an abiding belief in Hashem's rachamim, that he could have grown up curdled inside himself with enormous bitterness? And instead, he would let the pain that he felt, which he never got over, he never, even as an elderly man, the pain of having caused his father disappointment stayed with him. Okay, he believed that this was Hashem's rachamim, to inspire him to be responsive to other people's pain and disappointment, which became the central theme of his life. So the reason I'm telling you this story, which how many of you didn't know this story? Because I thought it was a story most people don't know. Okay, so the fact that this is what Hashem put into his life, if he could look at his life from where he is today in Gan Eden and look downward, would he see this as being a good part of his life? Absolutely. So the first challenging thought is, who has more rachamim upon me? Me or Hashem?
Hashem.
Hashem. Next thought. Nobody and nothing can change things. Only Hashem can change things. So this isn't going to take, this isn't a good response thought for illness. It is a good response thought for other things that distract a person from simcha. Give me another distraction. Lack of parnassa. So with lack of parnassa, there are so many if only ifs you could feed yourself. If only the boss's daughter-in-law didn't need a job, I would still have my job. If only I would have gotten an MBA instead of staying in Kollel, I would have a job. If only, could you see all these if onlys? So if you realize, if only I realize that nobody could diminish what I'm supposed to have, or add anything to what Hashem decreed for me. If I only knew that, I would be simple with what I have. So, in Orchot Tzadikim, he presents us with a whole different equation of how to deal with financial stress. The way we're trained to deal with it is, I need X amount of money, this is what I have to earn, right? And then it'll be okay. The best way is, I have to make hishtadlus for parnasa. I make hishtadlus, whatever your hishtadlus is, and whatever I get, that's what I'm supposed to have. So it means you could redefine the word enough. And there are people who live redefine the word enough, and they're besimcha. And other people, regardless of how much they have, are not necessarily besimcha. So, I'm sure some of you have observed this. Is it accurate to say the more money a person earns per year, the happier they definitely will be in their life? How many of you say that's absolutely true?
Absolutely not.
It's absolutely not true. Okay, and again, we're faced with this awful equation. When you don't have, it's hard. But it doesn't mean that when you do have, it's not hard. The only thing that makes it not hard is the inner tranquility of facing life with the will to find inspiration when things are good and to meet challenges when things are not. Last replacement thought. There are more there, but I'm not going to take you through all of them. The last replacement thought is that Hashem wants to present us with challenges because we would never present ourselves with challenges. Never. We love ease. We don't want any of it. Garnished. So, you know, if I was Avraham, well, if it was me, it wouldn't be Avraham. Okay. So instead of having a father who's an idolater and who's so furious at me for breaking his idols that he turned me into the authorities, I would yearn for a father who said, "Amy, baby, if you're happy, I'm happy. The main thing is to be happy. You have your way, I have my way, but here in Southern California, okay." That would be my fantasy, but that isn't what he needed for it to be himself. He needed to break idols. Okay, could you see this? We would never go down that path. In a million years, we wouldn't choose anything that would cause us to grow. We would avoid growth like we avoid the plague. Okay, so I want to tell you something about my husband. So when he was a child, he lived in Boston. Are any of you from Boston? You have one, I was going to say, one more thing to be grateful for him. So, Boston now is very different than it was when my husband was growing up. But then it was really, there was not much going on there Yiddishkeit-wise. So he grew up in a neighborhood called Dorchester. It was like a working-class Irish neighborhood. So he played with his friends from the neighborhood. One day he came up to the house and he told his mother, "Mom, I want to go to church with Pat." And she said, "What?" And he said, "Pat said the priest doesn't care, I'm allowed to go." Next day, she registered him in Maimonides. Okay, so in those days, they didn't have school buses that pick you up like at your home and take you to school and then return you in the afternoon. What? You walked or you took public transportation, which meant the walk to the train at 6, get on the train, know how many stops to stay on, get off and take the bus from 6. So at the time, that became his normal. Do you understand what I mean? We adapt to new normals. Okay, so he lived far away from school. So he was going to Maimonides. There was a teacher, I'm not making up his name, this really was his name, Mr. Lamdan. And Mr. Lamdan was the Ivrit teacher, an Israeli. Okay, and he saw that my husband really showed interest in everything that was Jewish and Hebrew and took an interest in him. And he would like sort of encourage him to go a little bit further. So Mr. Lamdan arranged a Shavuot night learning for the boys. So my husband's parents said, "You can't go. It's one thing to get on the train to go all the way over there. You think you're going to like come back early in the morning when it's still dark to 3-4 miles by yourself? No." Which is a normal parental response. So he was terribly angry and upset. So he told Miss Lamdan, "Gosh, you arranged this whole learning and I'm not going to come." And he said, "Look, why don't you just do, I'm sure in the yeshiva they'll have learning." He said, "In the what?" That's how he heard about the yeshiva of Boston, which had a very short existence, but he never would have even known it existed. It never grew. It was called the Yeshiva of Greater Boston. I think at its peak it must have had something like 12, 13 students. Okay, so I guess that was to separate it from the yeshiva of smaller Boston. Okay, so he got to the yeshiva, which is how he met Rav Hyman, who later influenced him to go to Chaim Berlin. It's also indirectly how he met Rabbi Margolis, who was from Boston. Somebody was from Boston. You know the Margolis? Okay, from Chaye Adam. Okay. Great tzaddik, and Rabbi Margolis was in a Vardika from way back. These were the people who were most central in his life. So why am I telling you the story up to this point? Because every single thing that we would interpret as being a negative was definitely a positive. Pat was a central figure in his life. Okay, if it wasn't for Pat, who knows what would have happened? Pat was a pivot. Okay, clear? And Pat, priest! Adraba! Okay, so, you know, so taking this a little bit further, he went to Chaim Berlin at 16. So some of you are of a certain genre remember how Torah was in America in those years. Materially, it wasn't the way it is today. Even my Beis Yaakov was different than any Beis Yaakov that you could envision today. I went to Beis Yaakov High School in Crown Heights. Did any of you go there? Oldies but goodies. Of course you went there. It was a funeral home. And they never totally refurbished it. So, you know, like they didn't take down the sign. And, you know, in one of the class, the third floor was the story in and of itself, but even on the two floors that the school used, in one of the larger classrooms, there was a bathroom coming out with an elongated tub that no longer, they must have done whatever. Okay. There was the narrow stairs that had the sign one at a time. Okay. So, you know, like it was a different world. So Chaim Berlin was a bank. Okay, they bought a building that was a bank, had a huge marble interior. The teller's booths were, of course, you know, the offices. And the dorm was upstairs where the actual offices of the bank were. So he got there. Now again, things weren't like today. There wasn't so much communication. And they discovered, gosh, they don't have a room. Oh dear, okay. So basically the idea was to clean out a machsan and that'll be your dorm room. Okay, so that's what he did. Okay, he discovered other interesting things about the building. At the time, the bathrooms didn't work, so people had to go to the gas station, okay, on Stone and Pitkin. And the gas station attendants who were used to this, as soon as they saw somebody from, I guess you have to go. Which, like, didn't do anything for people's self-esteem. The cook, who was a Holocaust survivor, tough as nails, he would stand in the kitchen with a pot on his head. So, I mean, it's only natural. You come from Boston, you might be curious, like, is there any particular reason you have a pot on your head? So he points it up. So, you know, like, this has to do with heaven. No, there's a leak. So this is, you know, this was Chaim Berlin of those years. So I think that everybody who learned there in those times was strengthened by the atmosphere. The atmosphere that kids have today in school give them the message, we're here for you. The message that kids receive then is, you better be here for us because no one's here for you. It's a whole different story. So these difficulties, again, we would never choose them in a million years. We would never choose them. But they're what build us. So if you're retaining simcha, you have to keep these thoughts in mind. So that in moments when you could identify emotional stress, you could challenge it. So this phenomena of challenging your emotions, okay, whereby your mind is in dialogue with your emotions, is the key to simcha. So it doesn't mean that simcha is intellectual. Simcha is still emotional. But your emotions, which are like a wild horse, are trained by the mind, which could act as its rider. Okay, taking things one step further. So we said before, simcha looks like what it is. A person who's sameach will seem sameach, will laugh easily, will be young in a certain sense. So, being besimcha is a mitzvah in and of itself. Now, you're familiar with the song, Mitzvah Gedol Liyot Besimcha. I once made a Sheva Brachas in my house, and it was a very mixed Sheva Brachas, not because I planned it that way, but because that's how it worked out. So, on one hand, there was a Breslover couple who got married, and the husband, I don't remember now if it was the husband or the wife, one of them was involved also with Chabad beforehand, so Rav Yitzchak Ginsburg was there. I don't know if you know who he is. A big Makubo. Okay, so I have that side of the table. And I didn't have a minion of those folks, so I had to get litvishers from the neighborhood to fill up the other side of the table, like sort of ultra yeshiva litvishers. So it's the sort of, unusual olam that you don't necessarily have at the same time. So one of the people on the Hasidic side of the table said, Mitzvah gedayel yopasimcha tamid, to which one of the litvishers said, which mitzvah is that? There are 613 mitzvahs. Which one is that? Is it in Rambam's minyan mitzvahs? And he actually opened a Rambam, and Rambam, the rationalist, says that the way to serve Hashem is besimcha uvetuv levav, and through that you fulfill the mitzvah of bitachon in Hashem. So the mitzvah of simcha can't be separated from the mitzvah of bitachon. It's one mitzvah. Bitachon doesn't mean saying everything is good and sweet. Bitachon means saying everything is as it should be. That means when things are uninterpretable, you step back and you say, Mishpatecha tahom rabba. Your midas hadin has great depths. We don't begin to plumb its depths, but that it's good. When a person is in that state of bitachon, then they can face anything. I once was listening to Rav Tauber speak. He told me about his early childhood, which is, you know who I'm speaking about, right?
Yeah.
So he actually, in his early childhood, he was in a labor camp. His mother, it was during the war. He only had one garment. All week he wore it inside out, and for Shabbos his mother would turn it on the right side. And he said the moment that she was Shabbos and she turned this garment right side in, if that's the way to say it, okay, he felt great simcha. So the simcha wasn't just because the garment looked good. I don't know what garment it was, shirt, trousers, whatever it was. It was because it made him realize that he's part of something bigger than himself. So the sense of being part of the enormity of Hashem's will is what bitachon is about. So it's not about denial. People use bitachon as an excuse to deny their emotions or to deny life's realities. No, bitachon is a response to your emotions and a response to life's realities, and it leads to simcha. So I'm going to stop now, and if you have questions, this is the time. Yeah?
Going back to the second part you mentioned, where you can't change anything.
Right.
So you're releasing control, right?
Right.
At the same time, very often in a situation that might lead you to despair or something like that, there are steps you can take.
There's no such thing as a situation that you should despair in.
Right. Okay. But using the example of, you know, losing a job, right?
That's yes. Yes.
All this only aside, there are steps you should be taking. You should be looking for a job. You should be moving.
Of course, yeah.
But how do you reconcile that with saying, you know, you're at a point where you're feeling like everything you're doing isn't working, right? You're looking for that job, and you're at that point. And so you say, okay, well, it has nothing to do with me. It has to do with Hashem. But how do you then bring yourself to a point to keep forward?
So again, let's look at this as an example. A person loses his job. He says that this is min hashamayim. If I lost the job, I wasn't meant to have it. So I have to do what? I have to take up embroidery? No. I have to look for a different job. This is what Hashem wants of me. He's taking me somewhere new. Now, in order to get this new job, I have to do what everyone does to look for a job. Network, read the want ads, go to Lishkat Avodah if you're in Israel. Whatever it is you have to do. This is where he's leading me. He's leading me away from this job, and now I have to find which door he's opening.
So again and again, you're in that cycle where it's not working.
So, round two. I didn't find it this way, I didn't find it that way, I didn't find it the other way. So every step that a person ideally, I'm not saying this always happens with people, ideally every time the answer is no, It deepens their recognition that they are not in control and makes their dependency on Hashem only and exclusively more real. So this indeed is why the Gemara tells us all of the Imahot were infertile. All of them. Now, we knew the end of the story from this that Hashem promised Abraham that he'd be the ancestor of many nations. So we know what that says about Sarah's future, Rivka's future, Leah's future, Rachel's future. So they knew it's supposed to happen, but it's not happening. So they did everything they're supposed to do, even to the extreme extent of Sarah, who brought Hagar into the house. But all of this is Hashem, you close the door. I'm going to walk through whatever door you want me to walk through to get to be where I have to be. So the extreme hishtadlus of Sarah by bringing Hagar into the house, which is what Hashem wanted of her. Her supposition, perhaps I'll be built through this, was absolutely true. She was built through this. The extreme tefillah of Rivka, the extreme hishtadlus of Leah and of Rachel, they were taking them where they had to go. Yeah?
On the flip side of talking about big struggles, on a day-to-day level, when life is just very mundane,
yes.
Routine and laundry and cooking, how do yes. you keep simple in those things, like in the actual very mundane part of life?
Yes. So I want to tell you something that's foundational. Now that you understand Simcha, you'll see that there's a very strong tie between Anaga and Simcha. The more humble a person is, the more they say it's all you, Hashem, the more Simcha they have. People think that Anava is low self-esteem. That's not Anava. Anava isn't somebody who really is Nebi saying, I'm Nebi. Okay? The highest level of Anava is when you have everything you need and more, and you attribute it to Hashem. When a person is young and healthy and employed and everything that they want, they say, it's not me, it's you. That's the highest level of anava, and that's what leads to simcha. So you could have two women, again, they're going through what in special ed they call activities of daily living. Okay, that means you get up in the morning and you deal with the kids, and then the kids go to school, and then you separate the laundry and you face the challenges of, is this shirt, which is white with black design, is this light or is this dark? If I decide it's light, okay. You figure out the sugyas of the shirt. And, you plan your meals for the day and maybe make a few phone calls. And it's going smoothly. If at that point you could stop and say, Hodu la Hashem ki tov, how good it is to do laundry, to have enough clothing, how good it is to have a washing machine. I personally, every time I get into the elevator in my apartment, I say, how nice it is to have an elevator. Okay, that hodaya, that simcha for what you have, is the greatest level of anava, and is the most authentic level of simcha. Okay, yeah?
Hi.
No, you're saying where do your own efforts fit in and taking responsibility for your own choices fit in.
How do you know when to draw the line and say, okay, I didn't do a horrible job, I did my best, but this is what was supposed to happen because Hashem decreed it, not because I messed up.
Okay, so here's how responsibility fits into this. Okay, so, again, quoting Rambam, Rambam says anybody could be a tzaddik as great as Moshe. Now you could look in the room and say, uh-huh. Sure, me and Moshe. Like twins. People like have trouble remembering which is the one who took us out of Egypt. Okay. So, you know, you think, Rambam, what are you talking about? So he didn't say anybody will have Moshe's life. You'll have your own life. But you could respond to your life as well as Moshe responded to his. So what that means is that there are expected responses. So you gave the example of a shidduch. So you're going out with somebody, and he says, what do you do in your spare time? You say, I like to read. And then you say, what do you do in your spare time? And he says, I like action. Okay. Or I could, you know, I could, like, ultimate shidduch horror stories. I actually know something, just look at you here and know. Okay, she went out with somebody, he took her to a restaurant, I'm not making this up, and in the middle of the meal, he leans over to the table and says, don't be nervous, don't be afraid. She was out of there in 2 seconds, she was like out the door. Okay, so if, you know, if you happen to meet Jack the Ripper on a shidduch, that doesn't mean, you know, doesn't mean you should marry him. Don't say it's bashert. Okay, so Hashem presents you with every opportunity to be a tzaddik. But you have to choose responses that'll take you there. So it means that if part of your path is to get married, you'll meet people who are potential marriage partners and people who are not. And you have to choose, you have to be real about your selections. But here's the consoling part. It says, Shomer Pita'im Hashem. Hashem guards the idiots. I just realized how extremely offensive that sentence was. Here's the consoling part. And then I said, okay, whatever. Okay, so what it means is that if you, out of your stupidity, close the door or open the wrong door, Hashem will guard you and open a different door if a different door needs to be opened. Okay, so that means that if you're making legitimate efforts that actually reflect your commitment to being in response, if you're making choices that don't reflect that, it's a different story. Then if you're trying to make your choices as best as you can, not as best as somebody else can, Hashem isn't there to misguide you or mislead you. Whatever you'll choose at that point is His will. And Maharal says at that point, after you're sure that you've really done what you could do, and again, we're not talking about what somebody much more brilliant or experienced than you, what you, the real you could do, don't look back. Yeah?
I wanted to know, like, if you get a ring,
yes.
Put down or criticized or corrected.
I once had a boss throw a typewriter at me. That was a reprimand. Okay.
But meaning that it's feeling like you feel not that great.
Yeah, I didn't feel that great.
Is there a level that you can get to? Like, can Simcha somehow, how do you get rid of that actual feeling? Mm-hmm. How does your brain?
Okay, so I'm going to take you to what incited me to have my boss throw a typewriter at me. I was working for a girls' orphanage in Yerushalayim, Bayit LePleitot, and my job was to speak English to the donors. So they have a system there, it was like an adopt-a-girl system, where a donor could pay a certain amount per month, and then he's assigned a specific girl, and he really would have to take responsibility for that girl's financial welfare. So the girls, in turn, would write their donors' monthly letters in Yiddish that had to be translated to English. And they loved their donors. They would call them their mensch. My mensch kommt, you know, like my mensch is coming this month, whatever. So one of the mensch came and gave a large donation, and I wrote a receipt, and I left out a zero. Okay. What's a zero? Nothing. My boss, who is on edge anyway, okay, and he's like a very high-strung, he's a very high-strung, nervous type anyway, was so upset that he threw a typewriter at me. So I came to an instant realization. Maybe this is not the career I should have in mind. So you could just, you know, again, if this is a door that's surely closing, then you have to say, what, yes. Now, suppose I would have had to stay with the job. Okay? Suppose there were no other jobs, and this is the job I have to stay with. So I'm going to tell you a fragment of one of Reb Nachman's stories. Not the whole story, that would be a two-hour deal, but just a fragment. So in this fragment, you have the simple person and the sophisticated person. So the simple person, they both had to learn how to make parnasa. So the sophisticated got out of the shtetl and went to the big city. In the big city, he saw, like, you know, people dress much nicer than they do in the shtetl. He got a job in a shoe store selling shoes. He was able to buy nice clothes and to have all sorts of things that nobody in the shtetl had, but then he realized being a shoe salesman is nothing. It has no status. So he began to see, like, who really seems to be, like, a person of status? And he saw that doctors have status. So he decided to save his money and to read as much as he can and to get himself into medical school in Milano, which in those days was the medical center of the world. So he eventually was able to do this. So he became a doctor. And even as a doctor, he saw, you know, a doctor in the end is only an employee. Who are the real movers and shakers? He realized the people in business are the real movers and shakers. He went into business, made a fortune. And at that point, he decided to go back to the shtetl to find a wife because it's better with the couple to have common ground. And he wanted a girl from the same background. Part one of the fragment. Part two. His best friend was a very simple guy. So when he reached the point in life where he had to learn to earn a living, he stayed in the shtetl. And he apprenticed himself to the shoemaker. So in those days, shoemakers actually made shoes, didn't only repair shoes. So his shoes were never that perfect. In fact, they were somewhat triangular. So people would like look at his shoes and say, those shoes look awful. And he would say, but you're buying them. So that's the fragment of the story that I wanted you to hear. So the point of this fragment of the story is that the person who's looking at themselves for their own sense of chashivus, in the end will never be quite content. And the story goes on to the ultimate history of the sophisticated and what brought about his downfall. A person who doesn't think that their happiness comes from themselves will make what efforts they have to make, but they'll live in the minute and they'll be happy with what they have. So if you recognize you're not good at the job you're doing, but this is the job that you have to work at, so you'll tolerate it. I'm not the best whatever. This is who I am. I'll do my best at it, and I have to have a life anyway. So at that point, there's nothing that somebody could tell you that's a chiddush to you, and nothing that's inaccessible, that's unacceptable to you. Okay, yeah? Yes. So I want to tell you something. My own feeling is that for someone who's not a survivor to talk about the Holocaust is extremely arrogant, and I don't want to put myself in that place. But what I will say is something. I want to just tell over something that I actually saw. There was a time that we lived in Geula, on Rehov Ovadia. Rehov Ovadia is semicircular. And in one edge of the semicircle, there was a tiny little shul called Sukkat Shalom, which actually was somebody's sukkah that they roofed. And it had like, you know, maybe 20 men could fit in, and you know, maybe fewer even. And the asbestoshim was the outside of the sukkah. You have the kind, it's not exactly Temple Emmanuel. So my husband was working in Or Sameach at the time. He invited a boy for Shabbos. And in the morning, they went to daven in Sukkat Shalom. So one of the regulars in Sukkat Shalom, a man who lived on Rehov Ovadia, was a house painter. He was a Holocaust survivor. He had lost his entire family in the Holocaust, remarried a younger woman, and had a new family. So And in those years, it wasn't so unusual to see this. A man who looked to be maybe in his 50s with a young wife and little children, and without your saying a word, you know his whole history. You could see the whole story without asking anything. So he would say Kaddish for the children of his first family. So our hero of the story, the boy from Or Sameach, asked the guy in shul in front of everybody, and remember how small the shul is, so everybody could hear everything. Eich ata adayin mamin v'borei olam, im ata savalta hamisa shel kol ha'yeladim. That's what he said. Now, the palace of the man understood his Hebrew. Okay. So this man was a painter, and not a Talmud Chacham. And he never had opportunity to learn because his entire youth was spent in travail. Without blinking his eye, he went to the Sfarim shelf, took down the Chumash, and read to the man Divrei HaBrit. If you do this, this will happen. And if you don't do tshuva im tochuiti bekeri, that will happen. And if you still don't do tshuva, and that will happen. And he read him the whole 9 yards and didn't let him walk away. And he said, and you know why Hashem does this? He does this because he's kel rachum v'chanun, because all of the other nations disappeared.
Rabbi Knaller mentioned that we have to tell ourselves that nothing we can do can change the situation, but then at the same time we have to put in hishtadlus. So where
right.
Does that line end?
The hishtadlus changes us. It doesn't change outcomes. Sometimes, if you change as a person, you deserve a different outcome. That's a different story. But the hishtadlus itself doesn't change the outcome, it just changes who you are.
And how does the person know how much hishtadlus is?
So there are halakhas about that. Rav Moshe Paskin, that the way you figure how much hishtadlus is enough is you look at the society and times in which you live, and you do what's normal in that time and place. Okay. Last question.
Going back to her example about the job and accepting that you're not good at something.
Right.
How do you not keep that upon yourself and, how do you separate that from yourself and the person?
So again, assuming you can't get a different job, obviously if you could get a job that fits your abilities, that would be better. But you could be a terrible programmer and a good person. You could be a terrible farmer and a good person. You could be a terrible anything and a good person. One of the former Rosh Yeshiva in Mir, I'm not going to use his name for obvious reasons, wasn't a captivating speaker. And he was very well aware of it. It's a big Talmud Chacham. And a new American boy came to the Mir. And he noticed everybody was coming upstairs from the Beis Midrash, but he figured there's the Beis Midrash, he should go down. So he's going down, everybody's going up, and a man stopped him, he held him by the hand, he said, don't you know, don't go down there, Reb so-and-so is giving shir, you won't be able to leave when he starts. Later he found out that was the Magid Shir himself. I mean, he knew he wasn't a captivating speaker. That didn't, asma. So that's it, but don't leave. As you know, I always collect tzedakah. So I have 3 envelopes, which also shouldn't surprise you. Let me just see, yes. Okay, so here, one of them, you can already start passing. Okay. This is for Neve Kalas. Right, we make them from, you have to marry them off. Okay. The second one is for a yeshiva ben hazmanim in Kiryat Sefer. So this yeshiva ben hazmanim is particularly successful. Now what does successful mean in this sense? It means that it keeps the boys off the street and prevents off the derechism. Okay, envelope number 2. Now, envelope number 3 is a different one than I ever passed. Okay. Le'ilei Nishmas, my husband, I was thinking what I should do. So he was a man of great integrity with everything. So I'm just going to give you one example of this. Okay. Ma'aseh Shehaya, there were some French boys in the yeshiva. And they felt that the yeshiva should provide for them ben hazman. But we're talking about something like seven boys. It wasn't worth it for the yeshiva to keep a kitchen staff of 12 people for them. And it was ben hazman. But they weren't going back to Paris. So there were bad feelings. So my husband heard both sides of this. He heard that the yeshiva doesn't need to provide for them, but he also heard that they felt ba'avil. They felt that they weren't being treated right. It wasn't about money. None of them were poor. So the solution was not to either urge the Rosh Yeshiva to b'cholof and provide them, or to tell them, wake up, you have money, go to Marciano's like you do half the time anyway. But it was to invite them to our house. Because that was that's what was right in the situation. So in terms of figuring out what's right and what's wrong, the only way we know is halacha. So many times people have their sense of right and wrong that are coming from their own past and their own emotions. So my son-in-law, who's good at organization, which I am not, put together, at least in potential, a Mishneh Brura Kolel at nights, which means there are 10 young men who are committed to learning Mishneh Brura and being tested on what they learn every week with tests that are marked in return for some money, with the goal of their finishing it and really knowing halacha, and then we could bring another 10 into the picture or more. So the young men in question agreed, and this is fairly unusual, to have an actual formalized Yisachar Zevulun contract with the sponsors. So what that means is that they're willing to sign that they're sharing their reward for the learning with you. Okay, so that means it's not giving to like an institution, it's giving to a specific person with an actual name like Yossi Greenberg or whatever. And so this is a commitment. I'm talking about a commitment for a year. Okay. It's a commitment of $120 a month. This could be shared amongst several people. It could be 6 people doing it together. It could be 10 people doing it together. And the young man, it won't be bachur, only young men. The young man will be willing to daven for the person who's providing this. And especially, one of the reasons I thought of this, besides that it fit, was that there are always people who I come across in my travels here in America, young women who would love to be married but are not married, who want a schus in real limud Torah. This is an opportunity. There are married women who, for various reasons, husbands are not in a position to learn, who want the schus of limud Torah. So this is the opportunity to have an actual contractual Yisachar Zevulun reality. So any of you who are interested in this, please come to me afterwards. Okay, and for the rest of you, I'm just going to pass the envelope and put in whatever you want towards this. Okay, so we just take the contract out of here. Okay, hold on. Okay. Again, if any of you think that you're interested in the contractual relationship with this, come to me now, and I'll tell you what to do.
Thank you very much.
Hi. Yeah, I know.
Yeah, how are you?
You can leave them out in your habitat.
I'd like to do this.
Okay, good. So let me tell you what to do. I have so far actually 5 people, which to me is like only after only 1 effort. So you have to take responsibility for $120 a month.